No change without struggle. No one in power ain't giving up nothing. No change without struggle. No one in power.
Hello, welcome to A Public Affair. I am STD Norway. We will be talking with Steve Horn about who or what are the powers behind the rallies that are going on all over the country today, right here in our city, to so-called liberate or to reopen the economy. And we are going straight from here to Steve Horn. He wrote an article in The Smog. And sorry, Steve, The Smog is disturbing me from finding your bio, but here you are. Steve, who lived here, is now former research fellow and writer for The Smog blog and a freelance investigative journalist based in San Diego, California. He currently works as a climate reporter and producer for The Real News Network, and we are talking about his article, very recent, April 20th, COVID-19 liberate groups are the same ones pushing climate denial. And I'm very glad, Steve, to have you, because one thing that has been really foremost in my mind is the fact that we've been talking so much about COVID that we haven't been talking much about the climate crisis, which will still be with us after COVID, hopefully, is resolved. So good to have you making the connections, and tell us, what are the connections between these people who are right now rallying in our Capitol building, demanding to reopen the economy? I have not seen pictures or anything, because of course I started the show the same time that they started the rally, but if to judge by previous rallies, many of them are probably not wearing masks. Many of them probably have an array of firearms on them. What's the connection between these rallies and crisis denial?
Yeah, well, yeah, thanks for having me on, and it's good to be back on your show.
Lovely to have you.
Thanks. And yeah, the connection is, it's, I would put it at two different nodes. So node one is the techniques themselves that have been used, and really the denial playbook. And so that was written about a publication that is disseminated by Yale on climate communications. But basically, they walk you through all of the steps that are common in climate denial, and you see direct parallels. So first, it's literal denial that it's even a scientific issue, or that it's like that's fake, or that it's a hoax. Those are kind of words you hear. So that's like the step one. That's kind of what we heard with this, is that it's just like really nothing, and it's like people are just panicking and there's really nothing to it. And then like the middle stage is, oh, it's just not really that bad. People are being too extreme. It's sort of like, it's just like the flu. It's just sort of like climate change too. There's among the right wing that talks about that issue, that's the same type of thing that that they say. And then they call it alarmism. And then and sort of the last step of it, and I'm kind of skipping steps in between, there's five steps that they outline, but they're sort of all similar in between. But step three is acceptance, but not complete acceptance. It's sort of like we accept it, but we don't accept that we have to do anything about it, because the economic cost of doing so would be too high. And so that's what we hear, to be frank, not only among conservatives on climate change, but also among a lot of Democrats, especially like centrist Democrats. But very clearly that's becoming more of the thing within the GOP right now is sort of, yeah, climate change is a thing. They kind of like underplay how exactly serious it is. They say, yeah, it's a thing, but like, it's just so expensive. We can't change our economy because of it. Well, of course, now we're seeing the same thing with coronavirus. We're seeing the whole discussion now is really, you know, kind of paying lip service to the public health expenses of this and, you know, the toll in lives that it's taking, you know, people's bodies being put into refrigerated vehicles in New York City, mass graves being dug up. Oh, nothing to see there. It's not that big of a deal. We need to get on. We need to, quote unquote, open the economy, right? So you don't really talk about the horrors of what is happening or what could happen. Same thing with climate change, right? Like when people say that they care about climate change, they're not really saying, oh, we're really concerned about these wildfires that burned down an entire town in California a couple of years ago. They don't talk about the magnitude of how bad it is and how bad it can get. They kind of pay lip service to but say that the economic costs be twice. So those are the tactics, just real quickly. But more striking to me was, okay, are these just, it's not just like a common language and framework. It's actually that it is literally the same players involved in the climate denial machine and the machinery as with COVID-19 and reopening the economy push. So, and the Tea Party going back a decade. So the Tea Party, of course, that network was not completely spontaneous either. That was, a lot of that was vestiges of not only the climate denial network, but also just the general right-wing infrastructure that's been built up in this country over decades. But that's the real parallel here is the Tea Party, because it was seemingly very spontaneous. They're all really upset and angry about Obamacare. They're really angry about the cap and trade bill, the federal climate bill at the time. And all of a sudden there's people out in the streets. The media is covering it. They were carrying their signs and stuff. And lo and behold, we're kind of seeing a similar moment right now. But I would say even more racist now with, you know, the type of stuff we're seeing. We're seeing Nazi flags among some of the people who are participating. We're seeing Confederate flags being carried, as you mentioned. People, you know, Kentucky, they actually stormed the Capitol with, you know, rifles. So it's really scary, like how far right this movement has shifted, and like how it's almost like an afterthought in the way we talk about it. Like that would have been unimaginable 10 years ago, if those people, if there was this many people doing that in this many states. And now it's just like, it's a lot of Nazis in different states. So, yeah, but it's the same groups. Like, I'm not saying these groups are like Nazi groups. I'm saying like the groups that are behind promoting it mostly. I wouldn't say exactly, at least at first, they weren't organizing their people or their supporters to do this, but they were. Once it happened, they hopped on board. So we saw, you know, what my article was about is the first few states that were having big protests, which was Michigan, which was Idaho, which was North Carolina. Now it's grown. It's all across the country in lots of states. But the commonality was these groups are members of something called the State Policy Network, which is, you know, seemingly like a world of conservative think tanks in different states across the country, including where you are in Wisconsin. There's at least one or two members of the State Policy Network. But yeah, these groups were either, you know, promoting it on social media or writing about it on their blogs, or were in the case of Michigan, you know, writing about it and then linking to the live stream of it, which was, you know, published on Breitbart.com, which of course is the website that was owned by Robert Mercer, who is one of the main funders of Donald Trump. And Breitbart, of course, was run by Steve Bannon. Steve Bannon, until he left and joined the Trump campaign, and then he worked in the Trump White House for a while. So, this stuff runs not only like through this right-wing infrastructure, it runs straight to Trump. So my story was really the first one to kind of chronicle this in this way, like the groups and the people. And the State Policy Network, real quickly, is also funded, you know, by the Mercers, by the DeVos Family Foundation, Betsy DeVos being the U.S. Secretary of Education. And so, yeah, these groups coordinate among one another, and it was a creation the State Policy Network, actually of the American Legislative Exchange Council, which is something that I investigated many years ago now, back in 2013. But basically, I found a document that said that, these kind of ALEC is basically an organization that does quote-unquote model bills that are written by and voted on by lobbyists at these annual meetings. And most of its members, it's a kind of a joint membership between lobbyists and mostly Republican Party state legislators. And they vote, lobbyists, my former boss, Lisa Graves, the way that she summed it up is at ALEC, when you go to those meetings, the lobbyists have a voice in the closed door rooms, and they have a vote on what model legislation gets passed. And then that model legislation gets taken up in state legislatures across the country. So when you see like 10 bills that seem similar in different states, often it's probably because ALEC was behind it. And so, anyway, ALEC created SPN as a messaging force, basically, as something that legitimized these ideas that wouldn't normally be popular and to give them sort of a populist veneer and a scholarly veneer. And so the way that when I was at Center for Media and Democracy and after I worked there too, the way that we were describing State Policy Network, which is, of course, the messaging force and behind this Liberate America movement now today, we refer to them as stink tanks. Like they get like really like ideas that people would find loathsome out there, package them in a different way, and get more acceptance of them. And so that's sort of like the summary of what I see happening right now. And that's sort of the framework of the article that I wrote.
Yeah. So Steve, we do have a caller for you. Bernie, you're on the air.
Good afternoon. Steve, great research there. I think it's unfortunate that the pushback is limited to right-wingers. My wife and I just voted for Bernie Sanders. We voted for Tony Evers. But we're very opposed to the safer at home practice, that's been put into place. Part of it is the economic damage that's being done to people, and also damage to their health in various ways, the stress, the lack of normal, preventive medical procedures going on. But more importantly, the numbers, the official numbers from the World Health Organization, the CDC, the Trump administration, about the lethality of COVID-19, other than vulnerable populations. There are many experts in the fields of medicine and biology around the world that have questioned that. One source is a site called off-guardian.org. It's out of Britain. Another would be globalresearch.ca out of California. And, of course, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and his childrenshealthdefense.org. RFK Jr. has been wonderful in trying to fight vaccines and mandatory vaccines and looking for safety in vaccines. And there are many other, Del Bigtree, many other people that have done that with integrity, not, unscientific people, but following the research and following the interests of big pharma. There are so many things to say, but our firm belief upon looking at other sources and listening to other experts is that this is vastly overblown in terms of lethality to the general population. And the impact, I have talked to people knowing that, secondhand sources and firsthand sources of many small businesses that already will not reopen their doors. I talked to a former colleague yesterday of talking about the fear and anxiety in her 11-year-old grandson, not going to school, not playing with his friends. I mean, there are many serious aspects to this, but I invite you to please check out sites like, Global Research and, I think there's an agenda here, and I think progressives should be as afraid of this agenda as anybody else. And I think our governor is a good man, but like many people who are honest, and he's a rare honest good governor, been fed wrong information. Thanks for taking my thoughts.
Bernie, before you leave, as I remember, you told us on this show that in 2016 you voted for Trump. Am I remembering correctly?
My wife, who always has voted Democratic for everything else and also for the Green Party, I voted for Jill Stein. My wife voted for Trump. She's not voting for Trump again, and we're probably going to vote for Howie Hawkins or whoever the Green candidate is after Bernie threw it in, as we knew he would, to the corporate Dems. But in general, no, we've never, you know, other than that exception, an excellent memory, Esty, we have, you know, we weren't going to vote for Hillary Clinton. I wasn't going to vote for Trump. My wife believed some of the rhetoric he was saying about getting out of the foreign wars and draining the swamp and blah, blah, blah. I never bought it. But to me, it's kind of like two corporate parties. At the state level, it makes a big difference, Democrat versus Republican on most things. But I really feel, so I mean, other than that one exemption, neither my wife nor I have ever voted for a Republican.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks. Steve, your response to Bernie.
Yeah, well, I think that I want to just first of all talk about it, like the point about the damages that shutting down the economy has had cannot be like belittled by people who are progressives or on the left. Like that's the thing. I don't want to come across saying that the people who are out protesting are like complete lunatics or something. I mean, I think that I'll get to the second point about the health part, but like their grievances about the economy and their concerns about their livelihoods cannot just be like, you know, thrown under the bus. You can't just call these people like complete pawns of an AstroTurf network, because that's sort of what happened with the Tea Party network 10 years ago. Those people were just kind of called puppets of the Koch network and sort of you know, called idiots, basically. And then, you know, lo and behold, like that's a generation of people that have been abandoned by liberals and progressives. And instead of like trying, I'm not saying that you'd be completely successful with converting them, but like, you know, you have to like meet them where they're at and talk to them. And this is something that Noam Chomsky was saying 10 years ago. So, you know, the Tea Party people have real grievances, just the way that they're handling it and like, you know, being cajoled and manipulated on those grievances. That's not the best, but yeah. And that goes to the, you know, the last thing I'll say about that is the Democratic Party at the national level is not offering robust and real solutions that are going to really help these people in this time of need. So, you know, Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi and even Bernie Sanders, like when push came to shove for the first stimulus bill, they didn't really fight for things that would really help the people who are hurting the most. And so I think that the natural outcome is that people feel abandoned, like they didn't get really a whole lot or enough out of it, and that they flock to, you know, sometimes in this case, like extremism. So I think that that's a real thing. I think that Bernie raised a good point there. The other point about the science of COVID, though, is, you know, I think that we should take it. I see where he's coming from, that he read some resources and is coming to some different conclusions. And I've seen that among some of my friends, people in my networks who are skeptical and also skeptical of vaccines and stuff. But I mean, if you're really reading, like, it just seems like there's a very developing scientific consensus around this. Not only within like the government agencies, which I could see maybe being a little bit skeptical if it's the government telling you something, but it's also like scientists at medical institutions, scientists at universities, and pretty much everyone's saying, first of all, this is way more lethal if you contract it potentially than the flu, and the symptoms are way more severe. So it's not just about dying. It's like if you get it, how like much it could potentially change your life. And of course, it's only a small percentage of people like that it could get that serious. But the fact that how quickly this thing spreads as a virus, and, you know, this is a big country in terms of the number of people, you know, that could mean millions of lives. You know, it could, at the worst, it could mean millions of deaths, but it could mean just millions of very serious illnesses. And I think the last thing I just want to say about it is we do not, and this goes back to, this is a bipartisan problem caused by both parties. We do not have a medical system, you know, so a healthcare system or a medical system that's equipped to deal with this if it becomes really huge. And that's really why these precautions are being taken. It's a failure on our medical system. So like people have compared us to Sweden, for example. This is the last thing I'll say. Sweden is a country that has a more robust medical system, that has a more public health care system and has a way that, you know, they can open up their economy a little more than here, and maybe in a way because they have infrastructure to deal with it in the way that the United States does because of decades of failure to invest in public welfare. Whereas Sweden, of course, is known as a public, you know, as a social welfare state. So I just think that those are important things to put on the table when you're talking about these things.
Mm-hmm. We are talking with Steve Horn, who is a freelance investigative journalist and climate reporter and producer for the Real News Network. And before we go to any other calls, Steve, I want to ask you about Stephen Moore. I was thinking about it because of the call that we just had from Bernie. I want you to tell us who he is because he's important in the case of Wisconsin. But I also want to quote, there's a lot of noise. I don't know if I'm only hearing it or if it's on the line. But one thing that he said recently is that the stay at home is a propaganda campaign of the left, which I think is so absurd because, of course, it comes from healthcare authorities who probably actually a lot of them are on the right, being that doctors generally have quite a lot of money, and that seems to be what determines your affiliation in this country. So who is he? And I really think that this is a very interesting thing that he said. He, of course, is also the one who said that he has worked with a donor who agreed to cover bail and legal fees for anyone who gets arrested today. Tell us about him.
Yeah, so there's a couple. I want to talk about like the Wisconsin example second, because I think that's crucial here, and I think that we may have some indications of who that donor might be, although there's no confirmation, but I'll talk about that in a second. In terms of Stephen Moore, he's the perfect depiction of the alliance between Trump and this broader right-wing network that I was talking about before. So Moore is part of that network, and he's also part of Trump's inner circle. So Moore was, for a long time, one of the listed people on the roster of scholars, if you want to call them, that's what they call them, scholars for the American Legislative Exchange Council. So he'd be someone that they would put out in the media as an ALEC scholar. And he's also currently, he's not that anymore, but he's still listed as a member of their private sector board of advisors. So kind of like the people, it's a mix of people in corporations, lobbyists, that kind of thing, and people like him who work for think tank, quote unquote think tanks. And yeah, Stephen Moore, of course, is more well known in recent years for being an economic advisor to the Trump campaign in 2016. And last year he was nominated to serve on the board of governors of the Federal Reserve, and he did not get through. And I think it was probably because he was completely unqualified for that job. I mean, he's called an economist, but a lot of people have questioned his actual academic credentials to be calling himself an economist. And you know, most people just consider him a right-wing propagandist. But this is a guy who's in deep in Trump's inner circle. And yeah, as you said, he's been advocating hard for a reopening of the economy. And he said recently, this is another depiction of the right-wing network. This was Zoom session, like a webinar kind of thing that he was doing, a happy hour type event for something called the Independence Institute, which is a member of the State Policy Network again in Colorado. But he basically, that's where he said the Rosa Parks remark. And he mentioned that there's a Wisconsin donor who would be willing to pay for bail fees if you committed civil disobedience and jail fees if you went to jail for doing that. And he didn't name the donor, and that's been the billion-dollar question, if you will, like who's the billionaire that would put up this money. And I think that we got some semblance of a potential answer this week. And then recent weeks, really, if you look at who's been the most vocal person in Wisconsin that has a lot of money on quote-unquote reopening the economy, it's been Liz Uihlein, who is the wife of Richard Uihlein. And Richard Uihlein is the founder and the CEO of Uihlein Corporation, which is a packaging corporation based in Kenosha, Wisconsin, in Kenosha County, but has sites all across the country. And he is a major... the major donor to a super PAC for this cycle for Trump's election. And yeah, basically she's saying the same kind of things, that this is an overblown thing, that we need to reopen the economy, we're exaggerating the risks. And of course, they have a corporate benefit to that happening through Uihlein Corporation. And yeah, so I think that if I had to put a hypothesis on it, like my first guess of who's the donor who'd be willing to put up money for bail and jail, it would probably be Liz Uihlein and Richard Uihlein, at least in Wisconsin.
Yeah, and we actually heard how people there had to keep working, which, I mean, a lot of people, like we heard from Bernie, and like we know, would be happy to work, but they received this email saying if you have any symptoms of cold or, you know, anything that looks like COVID-19, please don't let anyone know about that, which I think is very interesting. But we have not a whole lot of time, so I want to ask you about another Madison-related, in this case, firm, Reopen North Carolina has retained the legal services of Michael Best and Friedrich of Wisconsin. We hear their promos on public radio every once in a while. They are one of the sponsors there. Tell us about who they are and why they would be representing the so-called liberators of North Carolina.
Yeah, that's a good, really important question, important tie-in. Ties into Wisconsin because they have a presence in Madison. And, for example, Michael Best and Friedrich was the firm that represented the GOP when they were shoving through AB 10 back in 2011. The
union plan, as we know it, yes.
Yeah, so, yeah, the New York Times was the first to report that they're representing Reopen North Carolina. And, of course, as I wrote about in my article, the Reopen North Carolina thing is being heavily pushed by another member of the state policy network called the Civitas Institute, and a particularly big donor there who's been outspoken about it through right-wing media outlets. But, yeah, so that's... the other important tie-in for them to, you know, because again, everything you see is it's an alliance between the Trumpian wing of the party and then like the old guard Koch brothers, ALEC, State Policy Network wing of the party. So Michael Best and Friedrich, who works there, well, none other than Reince Priebus, who worked there before he worked for the Trump White House for a while, and then he has returned there since he left the Trump White House. And Reince Priebus, of course, is a Wisconsin native. He actually grew up in the same city as me, Kenosha, Wisconsin. We actually had the same exact teacher for civics in high school. So, yeah, he's close with Paul Ryan. But, yeah, you really see what is really interesting about a lot of this is you do see a lot of this ties back to the infrastructure that's been created in Wisconsin. So yeah, as we go forward, we'll probably see more and more connections there. Like someone that I might expect to see would be like Diane Hendricks, for example. I wouldn't be surprised if her name eventually pops up. And the one thing I just want to say is about Uihlein, and this connects to coronavirus very much. Probably the last thing I'll say about Wisconsin is Uihlein gave $10,000 to the Republican candidate in the Supreme Court race, and of course was the Republican Party that pushed hard to keep the election open, during this global pandemic just weeks ago. I don't think that it's any accident that we're seeing these same people still pushing forward now with this reopen the economy. I mean, they were pushing to keep the election open as opposed to delaying it or doing mail-in voting and stuff. So,
Yeah, yep. Well, I wanted to ask you about the irony. I don't know if we'll have time. We have only 2 minutes left, but that all these people who, I shouldn't say all, but these people who are supposedly liberating, who supposedly are against the government, against rules. First of all, the government nowadays is their government. It is the Trump government. But also, they probably are not aware to what degree they are manipulated by big money and how destructive that is for their lives, both when it comes to COVID-19 and to climate change. So I don't know if you can answer that in a minute, or at least your thoughts, or if you've talked to any of them.
Well, I think that the irony of a lot of this is on top of everything else you said, is that these groups and these people often say that they really support states' rights, and the states should have sort of their own say over things, not the federal government. In this case, it's states that are individual states that are making decisions, and they're kind of basically calling for the opposite to happen. They're saying they kind of want an edict from Lord Trump to open up the economy, and they're taking their signals from him. The whole liberate thing, as you mentioned, liberate Michigan, liberate whatever, with the different states that he mentioned on Twitter. So and of course, the thing with like the big money and all of that is definitely the irony of it all, is that there's always this this notion that it is a grassroots movement, but the Tea Party is the same exact example. It seemed like it was a grassroots rebellion, but pulling the strings behind it and giving the big money were the Koch brothers, Americans for Prosperity, and that whole network. So we're seeing a repeat of it now.
Yeah, well, Steve Horn, again, a freelance investigative journalist, climate reporter and producer for the Real News Network, one of ours. He used to live in Madison. Thank you so much, Steve, for joining us today. And thanks to Richelle and Shally. I'm STD Noor. We'll be talking again next week. Bye-bye.